And find the entire show on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door Organ and look for The Wave. So, Jim, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
Well, I just want to thank you for having me on. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I guess the one take-home message that I'd like to reiterate is that if folks are visiting the coast, please be mindful that you are sharing the shore with wildlife that make the coast their home, and to please be respectful of the needs these animals have to rest and to be left in peace. It's a hard lesson for some to hear. People don't like to be told not to do things, but it is extremely important for the welfare of the animals that do come ashore to not interact with them and to give them lots of space. That's my closing statement.
Okay, well, it's a great closing statement. Jim, thank you so much for taking time to be here today. It's been really interesting and informative.
Thank you so much for having me on your program. It's been a real pleasure for me, too.
Missed a show recently? You can find all of our shows on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door Organ and look for The Wave. Have an idea for a show you would like to hear? Email me at dina@kxcr.net to share your idea. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations KBOO, KCEI, PNW Radio, and KXCR for airing Beyond Your Front Door. And thanks to Oregon-based Jumpin' the Rails for performing the theme song, Smith Chapel, used on this show. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
Jacqueline Keeler, your host, and this is another episode of our weekly call-in show, American Standoff. And we are a KBOO show that examines the current political divide going on today in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And as we continue our coverage and examination of the ramifications of this political divide and its origins, which as a citizen of a Native nation and a descendant of a second Native nation, my father's tribe, that preexisted this present ongoing occupation by the United States of our homelands, I do see this as an outcome of that colonialism and violence and white supremacy. Like, this is not a surprise, right? I think a lot of people are unable, and even journalists are unable to really place the present situation in the context of the history of the United States as they learned it, right? And so part of what we do in the show is sort of reframe it and provide a lot of context that you may not have heard it before. So we are, we started the show on January 6, 2022, a year after to the day of the insurrection at the Capitol, where on January 6, 2021, we saw thousands of supporters of the former president gathered in D.C. and storming the Capitol, claiming their candidate, Trump, had won, right? And Oregon is not immune to this. In fact, a lot of this militia and armed extremism has taken place here as well. I review a lot of this in my book Standoff, which covers in part the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. And indeed, we also saw a armed insurrectionist, breaching our own state capitol just a few weeks before the Capitol insurrection in D.C. So today on American Standoff, we are looking at why Arizona matters, right? GOP extremism and the Great Replacement hysteria. I probably need to just do a show just on the Great Replacement theory because it's a pretty big part of what is looking at the different polling and everything that's been going on. It's a big part of what really radicalizes a lot of the electorate. I have to admit that electorate is largely white, and that's something that is not commonly discussed in the media because people shy away from naming it. And so, but I think it's really important that we deal directly with what the ramifications of history that we are facing. So in this episode, we will take a look at how Trump's big lie, and I do admit a lot of my shows are about Trump's big lie, is gaining ground in Arizona. And Arizona is, of course, a battleground state that I have covered as a journalist over the years. In fact, on the web page on the KB website for this episode, I do include two links to two articles that I've written in the past and I've cited before on different shows. One was an article I did during the 2018 midterms, Native Voters Made Decisive Impact on Elections in Battleground States. And there I review quite a bit how the Native vote can be the deciding vote in these races in a number of particularly of Western Senate seats. You'd be surprised. And of course, I mentioned Heidi Heitkamp's case. She won by only 2,000 votes in North Dakota in 2011, was it? Or 2012. And so she, and of course, that was a Native vote. And then, so a lot of my coverage during the 2018 midterms really examined the sort of voter suppression tactics going on at the state legislative level in North Dakota and other, and now many other states, and to basically suppress the Native vote and stop them from basically choosing the Senate. The senator, a number of Senate seats have been decided by the Native vote. So I go into a lot of this article is quite detailed and has a lot of numbers and everything in it. And I do also look at really look deeply at the Navajo Nation as well. And we're going to talk a bit about that today with discussing the Arizona voter suppression and election denialism. And then also the other article linked is The Fundamental Law, which is subtitled Native Americans Helped Invent American Democracy. Too bad they're prevented from practicing it. And this was published in Sierra Magazine. I had done the reporting on this just before the pandemic started. So I was traveling across the Navajo Nation and really looking at how the Navajo vote how it works, how the efforts being done to protect it, and things people are doing to try to change it, to try to change access, and particularly in the state of Arizona. So those two articles are very good, and I'll go over briefly some of the elements in them. You may wonder why we're talking about Arizona here in Oregon. Of course, Trump's focus has been on replacing any sort of opposition he faced in the Republican Party, particularly from governors and secretaries of state. And in the case of Arizona, of course, Rusty Bowers, who was the leader in the state legislature there. And they're really going after these folks that had prevented him from being able to overturn the results in certain states. And so we will also be looking at, in Arizona, we're looking at how he's been gaining ground in Arizona, how this could impact the outcome of the election in 2024. So, and certainly Trump endorsed 12 candidates for office in Arizona, and, they did very well, actually, in the primary. And so including for governor and secretary of state, these positions, of course, will play a decisive role in the 2024 election. And this is very concerning, as these candidates have loudly expressed, and you'll hear some of the audio today, expressed their belief that Trump is still president. Yeah, they think he's president right now, and that they would overturn the results of the 2020 election if they could. It'd be interesting to see if they actually will, try to, turn back time and, actually overturn the election if they get elected, the previous election. So, and actually that is probably going to happen, actually, I would say. So today we will take a look at how these developments will affect Native voters in the state of Arizona. Native nations. There are many Native nations in Arizona, and the validity of national elections. That the kind of radicalization of the GOP in Arizona. How that will impact voters across the United States. And of course, this isn't just happening in Arizona. We're going to actually review some of the things that the Supreme Court has been doing, and the local courts, the Arizona Supreme Court, and how that impacts voting rights and could impact the next election. So once again, I always sort of review on the show about the purpose of the show. So on American Standoff, we examine the connections between seemingly disparate events, like the patriotic, I guess you could call it patriotic insurrectionism that's going on right now, and its origins in white supremacy, the DNA of colonialism it exemplifies, and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands in the United States it facilitates. So these are all connected in my view of things. And I'd love to hear what you have to say, actually. So this is the call-in show, so please do feel free to call in. The number in the studio is 503-231-8187. And how do you feel about this? Are you concerned about the state of elections and what could happen? And so I'd love to hear what you have to say. So I always start the show by greeting you in my own language. That's hello in Navajo. My name is Jacqueline Healer. And in the Navajo way, we introduce ourselves to our clans. My clan is Kia'ani. Kia'ani Nishla, I am of the Towering House Clan, one of the original clans of the Navajo people. And those clans are passed down matrilineally. So it goes back to one of my earliest female ancestors would have been the original Kia'ani. And they say that we were made from the heart of changing woman, of Atzan Alaha. I am born from my father's people, who are the Yankton Sioux people, the Hanktamon Dakota people in South Dakota. So I am both Dakota and I am Diné. That's what Navajo call ourselves, Diné. So sometimes I like to call myself Diné Kota. It's kind of this silly little thing I put together. So anyway, and the question I ask each episode is, in the more than the year and, I don't know, the year and 8 months going on now that has passed since January 6, 2021, what have we learned? What have we learned since we watched, in horror, really, watched the Capitol being stormed, watched people being beaten? I would love to hear what you I'd like to hear people comment on that. What have you learned? What has this taught you about America and being an American? And love to hear your perspective on that. But still, despite the dire topic of today's show, we will actually open with some positive news. Yes, you probably already heard the news, but an Alaskan Native woman, Mary Peltola, she has defeated Sarah Palin for the sole congressional seat in Alaska. This was a special election. Of course, the previous Congressman Young had passed away, and so they held this election to replace him. And it's just until November, and she will have to run against a very short seat. But she's the first Alaskan Native to be elected to Congress. We've had two Native American women. For those of you not familiar with the nomenclature, Native American or American Indian refers to Native people who are citizens of federally recognized tribes within the main lower 48 of the United States. And then Alaskan Natives have the term Alaskan Native for them, and that includes the tribes there as well. And so they have a separate name. So so she is the first Alaskan Native woman to be elected to Congress. And of course, she's flipping a seat that has long been in Republican hands. And so Young had represented Alaska in Congress for 49 years. So Alaska's had the same congressman for almost half a century. So Peltola, who is Yupik, she is a tribal fisheries manager and former state representative who led initial counts after the August 16 election. So, but her win wasn't assured until Wednesday, yesterday, when Alaska election officials made decisive second choice counts using the state's new ranked choice voting system. So that is really interesting. I know that I'm sure many of my listeners are huge supporters of the ranked choice voting system, which could allow a lot more flexibility into our two-party system. If you're not familiar with that, it's where you get to choose, you get to rank your choices on the ballot. So which one you would choose first, second, third. So if it becomes sort of a choice between, if your candidate isn't one of the main finishers, then your next choice would then be, put down as your choice. And so that's how it sort of panned out. So let's listen to some of the audio of Alaskan Native Mary Peltola, who has just defeated Sarah Palin to win, and is now Congresswoman Peltola, who she's supposed to be sworn in. But let's listen to some audio about that.
With 91,206 votes, Sarah Palin with 85,902.
And I'm just extremely grateful to the Alaskan voters who put their faith in me, and just need to take a breath, I think. Yes.
You become the first Alaskan Native to represent Alaska in D.C. Tell me what your thoughts about that.
Well, yeah, I will have that distinction, but I think what's most important is that I'm an Alaskan and being sent to represent all Alaskans. And yes, being Alaska Native is part of my ethnicity, but I'm much more than my ethnicity, and I'll be looking forward to working forward for all Alaskans here in this short seat, and really focused on November and winning the two-year seat as well, and looking forward to continuing out on the campaign trail and listening to what Alaskans want. We need to get our constituent services back on track. I need to make sure that I'm reaching out to the other delegates, our other federal delegates, Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Dan Sullivan, and reaching out to future colleagues. So I'm just really excited and very grateful.
What are your first priorities when you get to D.C.?
To work for Alaskans, to build partnerships, to build coalitions that we need going forward. Alaska is facing some serious challenges in terms of inflation, in terms of very, very high energy prices. And this is these are national challenges. I'm looking forward to meeting more colleagues and just really buckling down and getting to work.
So there you heard from, I guess, congressional nominee, catching my breath there. Alaska Native Mary Peltola, who defeated Sarah Palin, and that win was called yesterday. And you heard her mentioning Senator Lisa Murkowski. And of course, in my Truth Out piece, I wrote about how in 2010, Senator Lisa Murkowski lost the Republican Party primary in Alaska, and was forced to run as a write-in candidate. Right. And she credits her success largely to the support of Alaskan Native corporations and voters, and is only the second write-in candidate to have ever been seated in the Senate in the U.S. in U.S. history. And so I write, just quoting myself here from the article, but even in their support of a Republican candidate, Native voters have different priorities for their elected officials than their white neighbors. Murkowski's vote against Kavanaugh has been largely credited to pressure applied to her by her Alaska Native constituents. So I included in this article a really great white paper written by an entity called Every Native Vote Counts. You can find it on the National Congress of American Indians website, ncai.org. And it was great. Pictograph, which shows the top 10 states with the highest population of voting populations of voting age natives, and of course Alaska ranks up there. So she had over 100,000 write-in votes in 2010, this is an older report from 2012, but that's 10 years old, honestly. But Alaska Native voters at that time constitute 17% of the votes in Alaska, and I'm sure it's higher now, 88,000 voters. In Arizona, and of course, so what you're going to see is 2 out of 3 of the congressional delegation from Alaska is there because of the Native vote there, and so it's a body that will be largely representative of the desires of the Native of Alaskan Natives, whose homeland Alaska is, right, and has been for tens of thousands of years, and then Arizona has in this much older report, 232,000 Native voters in 10 years ago, and I'm sure it's grown since then, and is a source of a deep concern from the Arizona GOP, which is why you're seeing a lot of these sort of movements they're making to basically suppress the vote. So other Senate seats that were won by the Native vote, of course, I mentioned Heidi Heitkamp in 2012, and who won by just 2,000 votes. And then in 2006, Senator John Tester won his election by 3,562 votes. And this was largely credited to the Native vote, which is there's about 50,000 Native voters in Montana. And I've mentioned this before on this show, that even in red states, they're really purple. The rural areas are largely Republican, and the urban areas and the college towns are largely Democratic. And so what happens is there are these very small margins of just a couple thousand votes sometimes, or in Arizona, sometimes it's just like 35,000 votes. And that's enough for the Native population, the Native voters, to be basically be able to decide. Like, they have enough votes to make the decision and send someone to the Senate. And so this is really what's under attack with a lot of these different things that are going right now with voter suppression. And so, and there are other Senate seats as well. Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota in 2002, he was reelected by 500 votes in South Dakota. Sometimes these margins are much closer than we realize. And so I go through a lot of number crunching in this article. So if you love numbers, go ahead and check out the article. It's linked in the show page on the website. So this is good news that we're opening with. However, as I noted, that things are still dire in Arizona, particularly after Trump's candidates had so much success in the GOP primary. Let's listen to some audio about how Trump-endorsed candidates were shining in Arizona in the primaries.
Trump endorsements help propel Republicans to victory.
Mark Phillips goes in depth on what the Trump effect means for their November general election.
Among Arizona Republican voters, if Donald Trump likes you, there's a really good chance they'll vote for you.
Whatever label you want to put on it, I think it's bigger than Trump, but there's something happening within the Republican Party that was proven out.
Republican political consultant Stan Barnes believes the Trump-inspired America First, Arizona First movement is gaining momentum, and Tuesday's results reflect that.
Arizona First phenomenon. And does it cut across party lines? Does it Does it cut across independent, non-affiliated voters? I think it does.
For every Trump winner, there is a loser. Count Speaker of the House Rusty Bowers in the latter category, losing by a 2-1 margin in his race for Senate against David Farnsworth, just weeks after testifying in front of the House Select Committee investigating January 6th.
The anger at me was because of the commission testimony. And a lot of the anger at my fellows was because they supported me as speaker.
Bowers believes the Trump factor may lose its charm with Arizona voters in the general election.
When you've done what you've done to alienate people within your party and then expect them to, you know, salute, and it's for the good of the party, nah, the party doesn't care about us.
Like the primary, both the speaker and Stan Barnes believe Donald Trump will loom large in November, but this time it will be more than just Republicans voting.
Yeah, so there you heard a little update from Arizona and sort of how well Trump is going over there. And I think that I disagree with Rusty Bowers, obviously. And you're looking at, I'm looking at exit polls from 2020. And it's very interesting to see that the level, of course, most of the articles that you'll find on that are citing data from the Edison Research for the National Election Pool, which polled nearly 16,000 people in exit polls across the country. And I definitely found that the support for Trump was still largely race-based. So you still have white folks far away. I mean, they are the main supporters of Trump, and so you know. But of course, they are bringing up again the whole topic of the Great Replacement theory. They are a aging demographic, and actually, for the first time, the Boomers and the Silent Generation, which is the generation that preceded them, are no longer a majority of voters. They are now a minority. And they are by far the most Republican supporting. There is an age issue as well. Younger voters are overwhelmingly Democratic. I think it's like 80-20, very extreme. And so with but they're still a minority of voters. And so as the population ages, you are just going to be seeing a much greater support. And I do wonder, and this, I don't mean to be ghoulish, but the impact of the pandemic on the older white voter, because so many of them refuse to, part of Trump's base is denialism about COVID. And so as I mentioned, these margins can be quite small, like 2,000 votes. In some of these states, and so losing COVID, large numbers of Republican elderly voters, white voters, could be very detrimental to the Republican Party. And so, he's still the candidate of white people, and so it's quite extreme. Anyway, so let's move along here. So once again, this is American Standoff. So please feel free to call in. How do you feel about the rise of Trump endorsed candidates? How they did in the primary, and what do they mean for the election in this year and also in 2024? So the next thing I wanted to look at was actually a recent decision made by the Arizona Supreme Court, which blocks an election reform ballot measure and which voids over 238,000 petition signatures this ballot measure will not be on the ballot. And it would have included a sweeping election reform proposition. It was a sweeping election reform proposition, and so they threw out 500,000 of the petition signatures for the state Supreme Court, so it would not make the cut. And so it would have checked the power of the state legislature to overturn the results of the federal election, which is very concerning. That is now there's no chance of passing anything anytime soon. Arizona didn't stop that from happening. And it would have established same-day voter registration in Arizona and restored a permanent early voting list that Republicans repealed last year and prohibited and prohibited partisan audits like what was initiated by state lawmakers. And so, of course, that made national news last year. That audit in which they found that, yeah, there was even these reactionary folks found that the audit, that the vote was fine. And so let's listen to some audio of that, the Arizona support, Supreme Court rejecting a voter initiative for November.
The November ballot.
It's a big reversal after proponents thought it was in the clear to be added in the election in November. Holly is here to break all of this down for us.
Yeah, it's a lot to kind of break down. Yeah. So we'll get right to the initiative that's in question. It's the Free and Fair Elections Act, and it will not make it on the ballot. This would have blocked the legislature from being able to overturn the results of the presidential elections. It would also guarantee ballot privacy and expand access to early voting.
An Arizona judge announcing today that the Arizonans for Free and Fair Elections initiative fell 1,400 signatures short of the 238,000 needed to make the ballot. The judge's ruling reversed his own decision from a day earlier that it would be on the November ballot after the Supreme Court asked him to explain his findings. There are two other measures that will make it on the ballot. The Voters' Right to Know Project will give voters the chance to require greater transparency for political spending, especially dark money donations.
So that's some local reporting there on the Arizona Supreme Court rejecting a voter initiative for the November ballot that would have prevented, sort of the overturn of an election by GOP operatives. And so this is very concerning, obviously, but even more concerning, I don't know if you heard this, but last year, July last year, the Supreme Court upheld Arizona voting restrictions. And let's listen to that audio right now. We're waiting for some audio about the Supreme Court upholding Arizona voting restrictions. This is the Supreme Court, not the Arizona Supreme Court. That's audio clip number four.
Now, this is a win for Republicans here. At the heart of the case is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which bans any measure that ultimately denies or abridges the right to vote of a U.S. citizen on account of race. Now, in this case, the court found in a 6-3 ruling that two Arizona voting laws do not meet that criteria for discrimination. Those laws invalidate ballots cast in the wrong precinct and ban campaigns or community groups from collecting ballots and then delivering them on a voter's behalf, something called ballot harvesting. Now, Democrats argued the laws disproportionately hurt many minority voters who rely on third-party ballot collection and are more likely to vote outside their precinct. Again, though, it's a win for Republicans who insisted the measures are race-neutral and afford equal opportunity for all voters. The decision comes as 14 states have enacted 22 new restrictive voting laws so far this year, with an unprecedented 389 proposed restrictions being put forward in 48 states. Let's get right to our senior national correspondent, Terry Moran, who's been covering the Supreme Court for us for years. Terry, walk us through this decision and the political implications moving forward.
Right. Wait, let's start with that. This is a major decision on Voting Rights Act, voting rights in America, in part because of the last thing you just described there, the campaign across this country in the name of election security to change voting laws, to restrict access to the vote in order to protect against voter fraud, very little of which has ever been found. In this case, Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the court's six conservatives, affirms that basically Republican effort against charges that it will impact minorities disproportionately. He says that's not the issue. He says, in his opinion, for the six conservatives, voting takes time. And for almost everyone, some travel, even if only to a local mailbox. Casting a vote, whether by following directions for using a voting machine or completing a paper ballot, requires compliance with certain rules. And what Alito goes on to say is, because these rules are on their face neutral. They apply to everyone. It really, and because the system is open to everyone, because it might burden, and he acknowledges that it does, Native Americans in places where it's very hard to get to precincts in Arizona, or African Americans or Latino Americans, if they have a harder time, as long as the system is open, it's okay under the Voting Rights Act. That's what he says in this major Voting Rights Act case. The liberals, led by Justice Elena Kagan, take a very different rule vision. They see this law, the voting rights law, as one of the most important laws on the books. There was an America before the Voting Rights Act and an America after the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act allowed everyone to get to the ballot. She says what is tragic here is that the court has yet again rewritten in order to weaken a statute that stands as a monument to America's greatness. That is the voice of defeat on the Supreme Court.
All right, Terry Moran for us. And I want to bring in Devin Dwyer, a correspondent for ABC News, who's also been watching this very closely. And Devin, you and I were talking about this. It's important to point out these were laws that were passed years ago, but both parties looking at this decision very closely, given what's happening across the country.
Yeah, what this is was a partisan case from the beginning. In fact, Republicans who were arguing in favor of these restrictions admitted as much to the court. They said, look, lifting these restrictions would harm Republicans, would help Democrats. So a big win, as Terry just said, for the Republicans across the country enacting more restrictions like these, but also a big win for Republicans in Arizona, a key state going forward. You know it, you reported there during the 2020 election. As we mentioned at the top, those two restrictions at the heart of this case, the out-of-precinct policy, the ban on ballot collection, those will stand, and it will be much harder now to challenge other restrictions going forward in other states.
And in Arizona, we saw the early voting, such a big part of the election process
80%.
There. Exactly. All right, let's bring in Kate Shaw, our ABC News legal contributor, also covers the Supreme Court for us. Kate, how did the justices come to this decision?
Well, so Justice Alito, writing for the conservative majority on the court, basically said these laws may burden minorities in a disproportionate way, but the numbers are small, so even if twice as many voters of color are impacted by this out-of-precinct policy, we're still talking about an overall small number of voters in a context in a state in which, as Justice Alito described it, it's relatively easy to vote. But remember, when margins are very small in a state like Arizona, even a few thousand voters being impacted by a policy might, you know, tip the balance of an election. So I think this is a ruling that definitely will make it easier for states to impose restrictions, harder for, you know, plaintiffs, voting rights groups to challenge these kinds of restrictions, and could really impact the outcome in close elections going forward.
Let's bring in, Kate, thank you. Let's bring in our Chief Justice Correspondent, Pierre Thomas. Pierre, as Kate was talking about there, at the core of this is, do these laws discriminate against specific minority groups? And there are going to be a lot of groups out there who will be disappointed with this decision today.
Absolutely. A lot of the civil rights leaders are saying that this is a solution in search of a problem, that if you look across the board, there's just not any hard evidence of widespread election fraud. And I can tell you the Justice Department will also be looking very closely at this ruling, in part because they have taken a stance or signaled that they are going to look very closely at many of these new laws that have been passed across the country in the name of election security. Just last week, they sued the state of Georgia, saying that, in fact, the new law that was recently passed by the Georgia state legislature did, in fact, unfairly and directly target minorities, Black Americans in particular. So the Justice Department, I don't think, based on some conversations I had yesterday, will look at this law and change their position, that they will closely monitor many of these new laws with.
Yeah, so there you heard some reporting on the Supreme Court decision from last year to basically uphold an Arizona voting restrictions. And some of these, Samuel Alito, Justice Alito's comments that this affects a very small number of people, that for the most part, elections in Arizona are free and open. You know, I go into a deep dive on how this is not the case in my reporting in the Sierra Magazine piece, the Fundamental Law. And the title on that actually comes from the Navajo Nation has its own court system, and they decided to get away from Anglo-Saxon, English common law sort of things, and really go to try to manifest a legal code that represents our own cultural traditions. And so this concept of the fundamental law of traditional Diné understanding, legal understanding, it's actually a really fascinating thing if you ever want to read into that, and I do report a bit onto the development of that code. But yeah, it's just not the case of the Navajo Nation. I think a really, like onto why voting is really hard in the Navajo Nation. I did a 2-hour interview with the staff of the Navajo Human Rights Office that did all the legal sort of lawsuits with the Voting Rights Act against San Juan County in Utah, which had egregious packing of the majority of the county are Navajos, but they packed them all into a single sort of district, and so they could never have political power or any say in the county, and so I go through that quite a bit, and they give some great detail about why they did a whole research study on mailing things, because there are few mailboxes on the Navajo Nation. So you there's not really, people don't have addresses. This is there's dirt roads. No, 30% of the Navajo Nation has no drinking water, no running water. It's really kind of shocking, right? It was shocking when I was growing up. It's even more shocking now if that's the case. The new recent infrastructure bill, Biden's bill, we'll see. It's going to be an interesting. I'm looking forward to reporting on that as well. Basically it means that a letter sent. It's also really difficult to get to a precinct. I mean, when you're looking at some of these Navajo places, it can be, we're looking at it can be like an 8-hour drive of the dirt roads to get to the white town, 4 hours away. I mean, these are vast distances. The Navajo Nation is the size of Ireland. To get to voting, and without paved roads. And people, you have to go there to believe it, really. And so it's not easy to get there with the vote by mail issue. There are a limited number of mailboxes in the community, and the mail the office is not open all the time. It's open 2 or 3 hours every couple of days. So it's not like the kind of mail service you would think of. And so people don't go every day to check their mail. And also they may not be able to get a mailbox in their own community. They have to wait for someone to die to get it. So then they have to take out a mailbox in a different community that is not in their voting precinct. So their address doesn't match their actual location. And so their ballots can be thrown out. So Samuel Alito is completely obscuring the issue here and missing the boat on that, I think. There's a really great report actually put out by the Native American Rights Fund, which is called Obstacles at Every Turn. You can find this at their website. NARF, NARS, Native American Rights Fund. And they did a great report, and I should say it's co-written by a mentor of mine, Dan McCool, who is a professor at the University of Utah, and has written on Native voting. They're looking at these issues, and in this report, it's a great report. I recommend people read it. They note that many Native voters living on reservations in Arizona have to travel between 60 to 200 miles round trip to access the closest early voting location. In Navajo County, there are 6 different early voting locations that required many Navajo voters to drive an average of 40 miles round trip. In this country, of course, we don't get the day off from work to do this. They may work in a different precinct than they're voting in, which can be a very big trip as well. So for Native voters in other Arizona counties, the early voting locations were 80 miles or more round trip from where they resided. In Apache County, a voter residing in Tignos Post, which is on the Navajo Nation, would have to drive 150 miles round trip to reach the closest voting center in Chinle. Wow, I have to go all the way to Chinle. That's insane. That's a long trip. I can tell you that. I've driven that myself. So this idea that this is a free and open election is simply not the case. And also, it should be noted that in Arizona, the Navajo Nation was provided with the Navajo early voting sites were only open for short periods, maybe 1 day or 3 days. And after that, voters had to travel significantly farther distance in order to get to the nearest location. So this idea that it's equitable, the voting is equitable, so it is not true. And I, as you mentioned, the lack of a physical mailing address being an issue with voting and ascertaining their precinct. Native voters are also a highly mobile population. According to the 2016 ACS, approximately 15.5% of the American Indian Alaska Native population was residing in a different house than the one they reported a year earlier. So, it can really suppress, and these sorts of actions seem minor, they seem, but they can really be very effective in suppressing the Native vote and preventing Native people from winning. And another thing that they have been working to, they have actually criminalized is ballot gathering. And this is where someone may go, an election worker may go into a community, gather the ballots there, and then take them to the precinct because the distances are so far to travel. And this has also been criminalized. In fact, a woman in southern Arizona who was a former mayor, she actually has been convicted in Arizona and is facing a sentencing right now. She's appealing it right now. But so that's it. That is the criminalization within the election system right now is really concerning to a lot of election workers. We've seen, I've mentioned this before, a huge loss in election workers because of the sort of the harassment they've been receiving, death threats, and all that. But also these laws coming up will basically leave them open to being possibly going to prison. Yeah. And so if they don't follow it exactly right, there's on the state of Arizona, there are a number of laws that have been enacted. We have, I'm counting here, 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's see. We've got 4, 2. So we have 1, 4, 5, 6, 7 laws that have been passed just in the past 2 years. And they prohibit all kinds of things, and they make them felonies. These are all felony convictions, and so that's yeah. It can these are things that apply to the county recorder, or election official, other folks, and so that is another thing that's kind of basically destabilizing our voting system. And this is not just happening in Arizona. Obviously, I have here a spreadsheet with just laws being passed in all these different states, although Oregon is not one of those states. So, but these are in many states that will have a huge impact on the results, particularly the electoral college votes, and of course the Senate seats too, which we've gone over on the show about why those matter. And so let me get along to the next clip. We're actually probably not going to make it to the end here, so I apologize. I am planning on maybe doing an after show, probably on my social media, maybe on Facebook or YouTube. So I often have too many clips to play during a show, and I think that I do choose them fairly carefully, and they do create a comprehensive sort of story about what's happening, and so it does kind of pain me not to be able to play them all, honestly. So let's look at this next one, which was Trump sharing the stage with a self-proclaimed oath keeper at an Arizona rally. Let's play that clip.
Seditious conspiracy is a very serious charge. It comes with a 20-year prison sentence if convicted. And it's a charge now leveled against 11 members of the far-right Oath Keepers group, including the group's leader, for their alleged roles in the insurrection. But they weren't the only Oath Keepers at the Capitol on January the 6th. Take this guy, Arizona State Representative Mark Fincham, a publicly elected official. In 2014, he wrote, quote, "I'm an Oath Keeper committed to the exercise of limited constitutional governance." In October, ProPublica obtained a list of more than 35,000 members of the Oath Keepers. Among the current office holders on the list is Arizona State Representative Mark Fincham. During the January 6th insurrection, he was outside the Capitol. Journalist Nick Martin found this image that appears to show Fincham right in the middle of the mob as people surge up the Capitol steps. So you might think this Oath Keeper was at the insurrection, would be keeping his head down since then, trying to lay low and avoid attention. But you would be wrong.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Trump-endorsed candidate for Arizona Secretary of State, Mark Fincham.
We know it, and they know it. Donald Trump won. with all the evidence we have, the Arizona election should be decertified with cause by the legislature. This is how the people can get justice.
Yes, you heard that right. That was the same Mark Fincham who was at the Capitol on January the 6th, speaking this weekend at Donald Trump's big lie-filled Arizona rally. Yes, he is running for Arizona Secretary of State, where he would be in charge of the state's elections. And yes, he has the full and complete endorsement of Donald J. Trump. Elaine Godfrey was at Trump's rally this weekend, reporting on it for The Atlantic, where she described the event as the soft launch of Trump's second campaign. And Tess Owen is a senior reporter at Vice News, where she's been covering right-wing extremism. Thank you both for joining me tonight. Elaine, let me start with you. Give me a sense of the atmosphere at Trump's crazy rally. Did it feel any different to the previous crazy rallies?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mehdi. So it was standard in a few ways. There were red hats, there was chanting, there was pointing and booing of the press where we were sitting. But it was different in a key way, which is that I think it felt, at least to me, a lot more sinister. I talked to so many people there, and every person that I spoke with said that they did not think Joe Biden was the rightful president, that Trump actually won and the Democrats had stolen the election. And a few people went beyond that to say they truly and deeply believe that the 2020 election will be decertified in the next couple of years and Trump will be reinstated as president. And I know that we know this is true. You read stories like this all the time about people who believe this, but to be in a crowd surrounded by thousands upon thousands of them telling you the same thing, the same lies, it's really something else. It really does not bode well, and it just felt very sinister.
Sinister indeed. Tess, you've been reporting on the Oath Keepers organization, which is a very sinister organization. How big and widespread is this group? How surprising is it to see a Trump-endorsed Oath Keeper candidate for elected office?
Thanks for having me, Mehdi. And in terms of membership numbers, that's something that's a bit difficult to say because I always take membership numbers quoted by the leaders with a grain of salt because they tend to inflate them to make themselves seem more powerful. But I think one key thing is, as Elaine pointed out in her dispatch from the Arizona rally, you know, the way to achieve legitimacy in the GOP these days is to rally behind Trump's election lies. And many people rallying behind Trump's election lies are conspiracy theorists like Fincham, who have ties or even official members of extremist groups like the Oath Keepers. And, you know, the Oath Keepers have been very successful since they were founded in 2009 in recruiting, you know, law enforcement, military, and state legislators. And so this has been a very troubling pattern that I think the relationship between kind of politics and extremism seems to have gotten stronger since January 6th, not weaker.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in places like Wyoming, where Liz Cheney, one of the people trying to replace her, is supposedly an Oath Keeper member as well. Elaine, I want to play you a clip of Trump-endorsed Arizona governor candidate Carrie Lake from that rally. Have a listen.
Come to think of it, there's a few other people I'd like to send right down to the prison down here in Florence. Anybody who was involved in that corrupt, shady, shoddy election of 2020... lock them up.
You have candidates for office who are Oath Keepers. You have candidates for office threatening to lock people up. You have the crowd cheering and screaming. You have the big lie. It's all pretty fascistic, is it not? We should use the F word.
Yeah, it is scary to stand in that crowd and hear them cheer for locking up poll workers and election officials from 2020. It was really jarring. And I cover this stuff for a living, and it still was pretty unnerving to me. I mean, what do we make of that? Well, I think Carrie Lake is not the only one. There are so many Republican candidates running this year, including Mark Fincham, who you mentioned, who are running, who are saying the exact same stuff, and who have a very good chance of winning in November. Arizona politicians, Arizona political leadership might soon be made up of these people. And I, you know, I was there on the ellipse for the Stop the Steal rally ahead of January 6th, 2021. I know what this kind of rhetoric can lead to, and it leads nowhere good.
Sadly, it does tend to lead in one direction, a very dark direction. Tess, last question to you. You've taken a lot of time out to really spend time getting to know these groups, covering these groups. The rest of the media hasn't. I mean, pre-January the 6th, no, most people have never heard of Oath Keepers or Proud Boys, maybe because Trump mentioned them. Did we drop the ball when it came to far-right militias?
I think there was a lot of good reporting around, you know, I think in like 2014, especially, but I think it's not fair to blame the media for sort of insufficient coverage, but I think there has been a sort of awakening across the board when people have seen, you know, on one hand, you have this extremist group whose leaders are facing conspiracy sedition charges and whose members were accused of planning, you know, using force to block Joe Biden from being president. At the same time, the same group has, you know, recruited lawmakers as members, and the leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, was at CPAC in July. So when the space between alleged sedition and politics is so narrow, I think that is why that's getting so much attention now and where we have a real problem.
Yes, I think that's that clip. You know, it's the denialism issue is a huge issue. You know, I wanted to once again, you know, draw attention to the racial breakdown of support for Trump, which is a major factor, I think, in Arizona and nationally. And the exit polling found that out of for they break it down by race, 58% of white Americans vote for Trump, and 41% voted for Biden. So if it was just white American voters, Trump would have won the election in 2020. And in this particular survey of 15,590 respondents, 67% of them were white, which is, I think, that's pretty much the national average. And then with black voters, 87% voted for Biden and 12% voted for Trump. They further break it down by gender, and black men were more likely to vote for Trump than black women. And actually older black voters, 92% of them voted for Biden. So you see, it's funny, with the black community, black voters, you see young Gen Z voters, and elderly black voters having the same dynamic. They're voting overwhelmingly for Biden. And so I think that's interesting, because I do think that ties into males voting for Trump in much higher numbers. So a lot of men of color in this country, and black men and Native men, have very low life expectancy. So once you get to the elderly range, it's mostly women voting, and so that's where you see this real spike back up to 92% of the black vote. That's my theory. and Latino voters, 65% voted for Biden, 32%, nearly one third, voted for Trump. And then Asian voters, 61% voted for Biden, and 34%, fully a third, voted for Trump. And other racial groups, they break them out, 55% voted for Biden, 41%, that's only 4%. So the Native vote is somewhere in that other. I think there was a whole meme about that. And so, I think we really need to keep our eye on this. My show is almost ending, so I'm going to just go out playing one last snippet here. It should be just enough time to do it. This is, you could actually listen to Mark Fincham. He might be in control of the vote in Arizona. So let's play the Vice News piece about people saying the last election was stolen, want to run the next one.
May 1st, and these are the candidates here, patriots, that are going to help us take our country back.
Of the people on that stage, the guy on the right, Arizona State Representative Mark Fincham, probably has the best shot at winning. He has Trump's endorsement, and his campaign has raised more than the two leading Democrats combined. In the past, Fincham's claimed to be a member of the far-right militia, the Oath Keepers. And he was at the Capitol on January 6th, though he denies going inside the building.
There's a whole lot of evidence that suggests both incompetence and criminality.
After interview requests went unanswered, we found Fincham outside the Arizona Attorney General's office in December, still protesting the 2020 election results.
Let me ask you about what happened in 2020. Would you have certified the election results here in Arizona if you had been Secretary of State?
Knowing what I knew at the time, I would have pushed the pause button and said, "Hold, wait a minute. We've got a margin of error greater than the margin of victory. It would be irresponsible to sign an official document knowing that there was fraud in the system." that there were discrepancies in the system.
So that sounds like a no from you then, that you would not have certified.
Based upon, you know, following that day through, if we'd have gotten to 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, I would have deferred signing it until we had one of two things happen. We either have an audit or we have the legal cases adjudicated, because neither thing had happened.
Okay. Well, okay. Then there was an audit, and then there wasn't any proof of any, you know, major votes that would have changed.
You have not even looked at it, have you?
We were here over the summer.
Okay, so you need to go to Arizona.
Sir, there's no evidence, though, of widespread voter fraud.
That is absolutely crap, and you know it. You didn't look at the findings.
I did read the findings.
It's not crap. There were investigations and so-called audits in Arizona, and all of them found no evidence of widespread fraud. And Fincham's still refusing to accept the results. There's not a whole lot of precedent here for what happens if a Secretary of State just refuses to certify an election. He popped up a month later at the first Trump rally this year, saying exactly what the former president wants to hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, we know it, and they know it. Donald Trump won.
Fincham was joined by members of the upper echelon of right-wing conspiracy theorists, like Stop the Steal leader Ali Alexander, the alleged Q behind QAnon, Ron Watkins, and MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell.
And I will promise you this, there's not going to be any election done with any machines or computers done in 2022.
These guys have plans. No machines, says Lindell. Fincham wants to get rid of mail-in voting entirely. But Arizona Republicans mail in their ballots too, at about the same rate as Democrats. If he's Secretary of State, it could be harder for everyone to vote. But don't ask him about it.
Sir, if you get rid of mail-in voting, will there be a lot of people in Arizona that you think may not vote?
No, there's a lot of people in Arizona that are demanding that we do away with mail-in voting. You probably ought to check the polls.
There were more than a million people that voted by mail, though.
Okay, you're not listening to me.
I'm listening to you.
La, la, la.
So that we'll go out with that with Mark Fincham, the Republican nominee for Secretary of State of Arizona, saying la, la, la. Thank you so much. This has been Jacqueline Keeler with American Standoff.